Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Crosby Kemper, the director of the Kansas City Public Library, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's lecture. And first of all, I want to say how grateful the library is to the University of Missouri at Kansas City and to the History Department for, again this year, allowing us to participate in the McKinsey Symposium. And John Herron, who I'll introduce in a second, one of the leading lights of UMKC's History Department, or indeed history anywhere, I will explain the McKinsey Symposium to you, but it's part of an effort that UMKC, in many ways, with the library, is making to bring the riches of our university to the entire community. And I want to say thank you to UMKC for doing that. Now, in introducing John Herron, I do want to say he gets to introduce Daniel Walker Howe, our speaker tonight, but I do, because I am a huge fan of Professor Howe's work, I do want to say a couple of words. I have a friend, the historian John Lucas, who likes to say that there is a difference that historians frequently allied between motives and purposes. And in American history in particular, it's important to take seriously the purposes, and I think tonight, in talking about Abraham Lincoln, you'll hear that, to take seriously the purposes of the men and women who made this country. And Daniel Walker Howe certainly has done that. He has taken seriously the attitudes and the, as well as the platitudes of those who have made our history. There's a passage in What Hath God Wrought, his great book that won the Pulitzer Prize, A History of the U.S. From 1815 to 1848, about a debate that took place in Cincinnati in 1829 between Robert Owen, who, as many of you know, was a great utopian socialist who founded New Harmony in Indiana. You can still go to New Harmony and see the remnants there, who was an atheist, with a debate between him and Alexander Campbell, who was an evangelical Christian. And they had a debate that went on over 8 days in Cincinnati to average audiences of 1,200 people about the existence of God and whether or not religion was a product of the fantasies of humanity or had a reality to it. A very polite and civil debate in which they would speak in the for a period of time in the morning and then a period of time in the afternoon, and I assume people would repair to the local taverns to receive other kinds of inspiration and revelation. And at the end of these 8 days, had a civil parting after, of course, Alexander Campbell had stood up and asked the assembled multitude for those who believed in God to stand up, and everyone in the audience stood up except for three people. But Daniel Walker Howe says about this episode, he says, "This episode sums up much about the Christianity characteristic of antebellum America, its commitment to social progress, its confidence in popular judgment, and most of all, its faith in rational discourse." And I want to say that I think this notion that there was and there is rational discourse in American politics and in American science and religion may come as a surprise to those of us who are faced with debates in Kansas on some of these subjects, but it is the purpose of the public library, and so it's an honor to have someone like Daniel Howe to talk to us tonight. Another book that I want to draw to your attention, they're both for sale by Barnes & Noble, by the way, is The Making of the American Self, in which he talks about the self-construction of Americans and, again, takes very seriously the idea that we are individually in charge of making our own lives and describes that in the lives of many great American figures, including Abraham Lincoln, and I'm sure we'll hear about that tonight. And that seems to me also the purpose of the public library, as a place where everyone in the community, that's why we're doing what we're doing at the Bluford Library, everyone in the community can find a way to determine, construct, build, develop their own self in a way that also has the collateral consequence of helping the community build itself. So anyway, it's an honor to have him here because I think he is one of the great American historians. It's also an honor to introduce John Herron, who has just published his magnum opus, Science and the Social Good. He was describing it to us last night, and I practically salivated. I need to go out and get a copy of it. From Clarence King to Rachel Carson, a description of how scientists and those concerned with science used science to construct a view of human nature and a view of the cultural world. It sounds like a fascinating book. John has worked with the library. He and Diane Beauty Burke and some of the other excellent historians at the University of Missouri at Kansas City at constructing beginning to construct resources for a center for local history in Kansas City. We have a rich history in our region that we should celebrate, that we should understand, that makes us who we are today. And John has been a leader in that and has also been incredibly helpful to the library in bringing the McKinsey Symposium here. So I want to turn it over to John Herron.
Well, good evening, and let me welcome you to the annual Richard D. McKinsey Symposium. A little bit about the symposium. The symposium is sponsored by the OAH, the Organization of American Historians, our main professional body. It's now in its 15th year. It brings distinguished scholars of American history and culture to our community to engage in a dialogue about history and national life. And we hold this symposium in honor of Dick McKenzie, who taught at the Department of History at UMKC from 1969 until his death in 1993. Again, according to my colleagues who had worked with Dick for many years, he believed that history was a living discipline, and he always tried to find a way to advance an appreciation for America's multicultural past through his approach to teaching history. He was the author of 4 books, more than a dozen articles. Dick McKenzie's interests covered a wide range, from art and the New Deal to American foreign policy and Harry Truman to Russian-American foreign relations. That latter interest would also lead to his position as a visiting professor at Moscow State University, as well as stints at the University of New South Wales and Trinity College Dublin. Dr. McKinsey was also instrumental in establishing the UMKC High School College Program, as well as the PACE Program for Working Adults. I welcome many of the teachers and students from both of those programs here tonight. Many of you are enrolled in the one-credit course that accompanies this symposium. You will be meeting with me tomorrow, but if anyone else in the audience is interested in taking this symposium for credit, you're obviously welcome to do so. And as a reminder, all parts of the symposium will take place right here in the library. So after the conclusion of tonight's activities, you are welcome to reconvene back here, 9 o'clock in the morning, to hear 2 more presentations. The first from Jonathan Earle of the University of Kansas, the second from Mia Bay of Rutgers University. We hope that you're able to join us in a continuation of a conversation that begins tonight. Well, before tonight's speaker, let me add a few more thanks to my colleagues in the History Department, especially Pella McDaniels and Diane Moody Burke, as well as our chair, Gary Ebersole, and our departmental assistant, Amy Brost. They helped do much of the heavy lifting that made this symposium possible in the first place, as did Lynn Clausen Day and her associates in the high school college program. The financial support for this event comes from the Bernardin Haskell Fund, and I thank the Bernardin Committee, as well as the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Karen Vorst, for her continued support of the symposium. And I also want to make a special effort to thank the Kansas City Public Library. It's always been our goal to turn the McKinsey Symposium from what was a campus activity into a much larger community event, and our relationship with the library is key to that goal. This is our second year here at the library, and we hope to continue that relationship hopefully for many years to come. The Director of Public Affairs, Henry Fortunato, his staff, including Todd Boyer, as well as Executive Director Crosby Kemper, have not only welcomed us into this wonderful space, but worked in ways both large and small to help make this event a success. Now, to tonight. It is from Dick McKenzie's interest in history as a tool for community engagement that we plan this event every year. Our goal is to pick a historical theme that will engage topics of contemporary interest. And this year we've hopefully done just that with our examination of Abraham Lincoln and his larger intellectual world. Again, if you've been paying any attention, you've probably noticed a little bit of Lincoln frenzy lately. The bicentennial of his birth, the sesquicentennial of his election have resulted in a host of conferences, exhibits, essays, symposia. Hopefully you're not quite burned out on Abraham Lincoln yet. If we can trust Google, There are more than 14,000 books written about Abraham Lincoln. Perhaps the only historical figure to gain more attention is Jesus. Part of the explanation must be, as historian Henry Louis Gates once remarked, that there is a Lincoln for all seasons. There is the Lincoln the atheist, the Northern Lincoln, the Confederate Lincoln, Lincoln the war criminal, Lincoln the savior of the Union, Lincoln the funny, Lincoln the melancholy. There's the gay Lincoln, the racist Lincoln, and of course, Lincoln the great emancipator. What Lincoln you choose to support often depends on which Lincoln you need. Well, with us tonight, to help us understand how the many Lincolns took shape, is Daniel Walker Howe. Dr. Howe is the Rhodes Professor of American History Emeritus from Oxford University, as well as Professor of History Emeritus from UCLA, where he still resides. He holds a Bachelor of Arts in History and Literature from Harvard and a PhD from the University of California, Berkeley. He's written on a wide variety of topics in America's early national period, but he is a specialist in intellectual and religious history. Among his many prize-winning published works are The Unitarian Conscience, The Political Culture of American Whigs, The Making of the American Self, and perhaps his best-known work that Crosby mentioned, What Hath God Wrought? The United States, 1815 to 1848, for which he won the Pulitzer Prize in 2008. As I learned yesterday, this is not Dr. Howe's first trip to Kansas City. As a college undergrad, he was here more than 50 years ago as part of a troupe of Glee Club singers. So, with that in mind, please join me in welcoming back to Kansas City, Daniel Walker Howe.
Well, after two introductions like that, you'll probably be bound to be disappointed by the reality. I do want to thank the Kansas City Public Library, for one thing, for the use of this magnificent auditorium. I want to thank Crosby Kemper in particular, the McKinsey Symposium, the University of Missouri at Kansas City, and the Organization of American Historians for all collaborating to bring me here and to put on this splendid symposium. Most of all, I want to thank Professor John Herron, who has worked so hard and so successfully to make all this happen. Thank you very much, John. No story in all American history has captured the popular imagination better than that of Abraham Lincoln's youth. A poor boy, growing up in what was then a remote area, he endured the tragic death of his mother at an early age and confronted the realization that he had no inclination to become a farmer like his father. Abe was a thoughtful boy, independent but not rebellious, tall and strong but not a bully, sensitive but not a sissy. We like the story of the poor boy who made good, but I do wonder how much longer his story will seem comprehensible to most Americans. The means by which Lincoln achieved his goals may seem foreign to 21st century young Americans. Lincoln did not get ahead by going to the right schools, or by going to school at all, or by cultivating the right patrons, not by achieving high standardized test scores, nor by seizing on a popular fad. He did not seek celebrity. What is more, not only the means, but the end itself of Lincoln's quest for self-realization may not be readily comprehensible to us anymore. Lincoln and his contemporaries lived in a world where, since time immemorial, boys had followed in their father's footsteps and pursued their father's occupational calling. America's open society brought the new opportunity for boys to leave home, often their father's farm, and seek to find themselves as Abraham Lincoln left Thomas Lincoln's farm and pursued a vocation more in line with his own inclinations and talents. The revolutions in transportation, commerce, and industry that the United States underwent during the 19th century multiplied the occupational options available. Also, since time immemorial, girls had followed in their mother's footsteps and become homemakers. But in the 19th century, girls as well as boys began to have the chance to leave home, earn their own money, and enjoy a kind of personal independence they did not have in their father's household, at least until the women married and became part of their husband's household. All this was exciting to the young people of Abraham Lincoln's generation. And as my colleague historian Joyce Appleby records in her wonderful book, Inheriting the Revolution, The First Generation of Americans. What made it all so exciting was not simply that these young people had a wider variety of economic opportunities. What made it exciting was that they could choose what kind of person they wanted to become. And then, through conscious, serious effort, make themselves into that person they had chosen. Abraham Lincoln was a self-made man in a way that we no longer use the term self-made. When we use it, we usually have in mind a business person, and we use it to mean that they have achieved upward social mobility. Specifically, we mean it in financial terms. They've made money. If we go back to Lincoln's time, we find the expression self-made used in a different and much more comprehensive way. One that does not exclude success in business, but is by no means restricted to it. Lincoln's idol, Henry Clay, the great Kentucky political leader, seems to have invented the term self-made man. What Clay and his contemporaries meant by self-made was not the same thing as upward social mobility, nor was it confined to monetary rewards. What they had in mind was a self-conscious development of one's human potential. In 1858, Charles Seymour wrote a collection of biographical sketches entitled Self-Made Men. Of his 60 subjects, very few were newly rich entrepreneurs. Instead, most of them were scientists, inventors, and statesmen. They represented the kind of individuals, Seymour believed, who were making the world anew during the era of industrial revolution, geographical expansion, and knowledge explosion. For the characters in Seymour's book, the creation of their own identities had been a first step toward their energetic innovation and constructive accomplishments. They had been able to remake their world because they first remade themselves. Abraham Lincoln was such a person. Better remembered than Seymour as an author today is Horatio Alger, Jr. Where Seymour wrote biographies of real people, Alger wrote inspirational fiction about poor boys who made good. Reading Alger's stories today, we are struck by the element of luck that comes into play. Ragged Dick saves a boy from drowning, and the child turns out to be the son of a wealthy man who gives Dick a good job. But these turns of fortune are not what the stories are really about. They are really about the protagonist's formation of character and self-discipline. This is why young people read the stories for generations until comparatively recently. And although the stories are about boys, they were read by girls too. My wife, growing up in a small town in northwest Iowa, read Horatio Alger's stories and practically memorized them. The moral of Alger's stories is that if you make yourself into the right kind of person, you will be prepared for luck when it comes. If Ragged Dick hadn't disciplined himself to be alert and courageous, he wouldn't have jumped in when the little boy fell off the riverboat. Abraham Lincoln's life told a similar story, if not one with a climactic single moment of moral trial. Like Ragged Dick, Abraham Lincoln determined to prepare himself for the right moment when it came along. With no formal schooling available to him, young Lincoln set out to shape his own character. Without the visual media of today, Lincoln developed himself through reading. Conscious as he was of the limitations of his environment, he might have read for escape, but he did not. Instead, he read for discipline. He read not only to learn what others had thought and said, but to find out how they did it. He read in order to learn how to think and speak and act for himself. Accordingly, he read classic accounts of individual struggle. Pilgrim's Progress, Robinson Crusoe, the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin. He sought out books about thinking, books about geometry and grammar and the hard conundrums of free will and determinism. He read the same few books over and over, making a virtue of necessity, of course. This way, he absorbed their lessons into his very being. Lincoln's contemporary, Ralph Waldo Emerson, lived in America's cultural heartland, not on a still primitive frontier. In metropolitan Boston, in the college town of Cambridge, and within the intellectual community of Concord, Massachusetts, Emerson preached the virtue of self-reliance. He said that we readers should treat books as provocations for our own thinking. He called for the emergence of independent thinkers and actors, for what he called the American scholar. No better example of Emerson's ideal American scholar existed than Abraham Lincoln. After the Civil War, Emerson could have added with perfect appropriateness a postscript on Lincoln to his book Representative Men, which Emerson had published in 1850. Indeed, Lincoln would have illustrated the self-reliant Democratic leader far better than the example Emerson actually chose, which was Napoleon Bonaparte. When Emerson came to Springfield to give a set of lectures, Summers in 1853, Lincoln was in town. He probably heard Emerson speak before attending the dinner given by the women of the First Presbyterian Church, who included Abraham's wife, Mary Lincoln. By this time, of course, Abraham Lincoln's own views on reading, on self-reliance, and on self-realization had already been formed and acted upon. Without having to read Emerson, Lincoln put into practice the philosophy that Emerson propounded. Among Emerson's circle of friends, this practice was known as self-culture. The person who was probably Emerson's best friend, Margaret Fuller, applied the same principle to women, making use of group conversations to bring women to a consciousness of their own potential. Countless kids on the frontier, in city slums, have encountered a blunt question. Do you think you'll ever amount to anything? Lincoln answered that challenge with more than just ambition. What he undertook was to engage in self-construction in search of self-fulfillment. Moral integrity occupied the core of the kind of person Lincoln made himself. Financial honesty represented one important part of this integrity. When his partner in a grocery business, William Berry, died in 1835, leaving behind serious debts, Lincoln worked long and hard to pay off not only his own share, but Berry's as well, going beyond his legal obligation in doing so. Lincoln carried his financial honesty into his politics as well as his personal life. As a member of the state legislature, Lincoln had worked hard to get the state capital moved to his own hometown of Springfield. As part of this campaign, he succeeded in getting the legislature to stipulate that whatever community became the capital must contribute $50,000 toward the cost of the public buildings to be erected. Springfield could meet this requirement, but it would force some smaller towns out of the competition. So, Springfield won and became the state capital. The $50,000 was payable in three installments. The third installment fell due after the Panic of 1837 had initiated a prolonged economic downturn. Stephen Douglas, the newly elected Register of the Land Office, had recently moved to Springfield. He quickly became a rival of Lincoln's, and he would remain a political rival of Lincoln all their lives. And, of course, we all know about the Lincoln-Douglas debates in the 1850s. Well, Douglas proposed that Springfield should find a way to repudiate its promise and let the state shoulder more of the cost of the buildings. But Lincoln objected. "We have the benefit," he is quoted as saying, "let us stand to our obligation as men." Money to pay the third installment was borrowed from the State Bank of Illinois and paid off over an 8-year period by contributions from leading citizens of Springfield, including Lincoln himself. There was more to Lincoln's integrity than just financial honesty, however. As a lawyer, Lincoln combated both in word and deed his profession's reputation for dishonesty. Lincoln won his nickname Honest Abe while practicing law in the circuit courts of Illinois during the 1850s, and He was often referred to as Honest Old Abe, even though he was only in his 40s. Colleagues ranked him at the head of his profession in the state, in part because of their absolute confidence that he never told a lie. In his notes that he made for a lecture to young people on the law, Lincoln advised his audience to dismiss from their minds what he called the popular belief that lawyers are necessarily dishonest. Honesty should be the top priority of a young person when selecting an occupation. Quote, "Resolve to be honest at all events, and if, in your own judgment, you cannot be an honest lawyer, resolve to be honest without being a lawyer and choose some other occupation." There are many examples of Lincoln's extraordinary intellectual honesty in his political career. One of my own favorites is a speech that he gave to an agricultural society in Wisconsin in 1859. Politicians at that time routinely praised the virtues of yeoman farmers, family farmers. Lincoln quite candidly informed his audience that he would not flatter them, that's his term, flatter, he would not flatter them by praising the peculiar virtue of their occupation. Instead, he told them in all honesty, "On the average, farmers are neither better nor worse than other people." Lincoln was consistently honest when dealing with the explosive subjects of slavery and its expansion into the Western territories. But this evening I shall instead discuss a couple of Lincoln's other speeches that illustrate the high value he placed on honesty. These speeches are very little known, despite their great interest at the time of their delivery, and I think their relevance today. The speeches come from his term in Congress as representative of the congressional district around Springfield, Illinois. And the first of them was delivered as a rebuttal on behalf of the opposition to President James Knox Polk's annual message to Congress of December 7, 1847. Nowadays, we call those presidential addresses State of the Union addresses. President Polk, a Jacksonian Democrat, had devoted most of his message to defending his conduct of the war against Mexico. Polk repeated his insistence that Mexico had started the war by invading the United States, and as he had put it in his original war message to Congress, quote, "shedding American blood on American soil." Members of the opposition Whig Party, like Lincoln, did not accept this account. They pointed out that the area where the fighting began between the Nueces River and the Rio Grande was actually in dispute between Mexico and the United States following the U.S. annexation of Texas. President Polk had sent an army commanded by General Zachary Taylor into the disputed area, and after repeated protests, Mexico had sent an army of its own there, too, in response. So the Mexican advance was neither unprovoked nor an unmistakable invasion of the United States. On December 22nd, when Lincoln had been in Washington only 3 weeks, he's newly elected, been in Washington only 3 weeks, he'd already assumed a leadership role among the new Whig majority in the House of Representatives. He introduced a set of resolutions challenging Polk's claim that the war had begun on U.S. soil. With the logical organization characteristic of him, this freshman representative ticked off his points. First, the spot where the armed clash took place had been an acknowledged part of New Spain and Mexico since the Transcontinental Treaty of 1819. Two, the local population recognized no allegiance to the Texan Republic or to the United States and had fled before General Taylor's approach. Third, the U.S. citizens whose blood the Mexicans had shed were soldiers in an invading army. Well, the House did not adopt Lincoln's lucid spot resolutions, but on the 3rd of January, a party line vote of 85-81 approved a resolution thanking General Taylor for his services and added a statement that the war had been begun by President Polk, unnecessarily and unconstitutionally. Lincoln's so-called spot resolutions are usually mentioned by his biographers, even though some of them don't know what to make of them. Lincoln's next speech against Polk's war management is even less well known. But it is interesting for its invocation of the principles of honesty and conscience. On January 12, 1848, Lincoln took up where the spot resolutions had left off. The Texan people's right of revolution to declare their independence of Mexico and to then join the United States, it extended only to areas where they enjoyed popular support, Lincoln argued. When Texas had been part of Mexico, the Nueces River had been its boundary. The people in the area southwest of the Nueces were Mexicans who wanted their homes to remain part of Mexico. Polk's justification for war, Lincoln indignantly proclaimed, is from beginning to end the sheerest deception, unquote. A powerful condemnation coming from Lincoln. Honesty was just as indispensable to the historical Lincoln as to the honest Abe. Of popular mythology. Polk, Lincoln said, should remember he sits where Washington sat and tell the truth about the origins of the war, as, of course, Washington was famous for always telling the truth. Lincoln declared, as a nation should not and the Almighty will not be evaded, so let him, the president, attempt no evasion, no equivocation. Addressing the president in tones worthy of the prophet Nathan addressing King David, Lincoln declared that Polk must be, quote, deeply conscious of being in the wrong, that he must realize, quote, the blood of this war, like the blood of Abel, is crying to heaven against him, unquote. Not having been truthful about the beginnings of the war or its objectives, President Polk can provide no leadership regarding its ending. Lincoln's manuscript of his speech reads, it is a singular omission in this message that it nowhere intimates where the president expects the war to terminate. At the end of 20 months, during which time our arms have given us the most splendid successes, this same president gives us a long message without showing us that as to the end, he himself has even an imaginary conception. He is a bewildered, confounded, and miserably perplexed man. Unquote. Lincoln does not interpret Polk as a wicked man. He interprets him as a confused man. Why is he confused? Because he does not listen to what his conscience tells him. Lincoln is confident that Polk's conscience is the same as his own. It demands truthfulness and honesty. Like Ralph Waldo Emerson, Lincoln believed in the universality of conscience. All our consciences are alike in content, Lincoln and Emerson agreed. But some are strong and some are weak consciences. Conscience, like other powers, whether physical or mental, needs to be strengthened by exercise. Polk had not habitually listened to his conscience and therefore now has difficulty finding and following its guidance. The historian, alas, must agree with Lincoln about Polk's failures of conscience, as President Polk betrayed the confidence of so many other politicians so many times that he became a byword for secrecy, double dealing, and duplicity. For a long time, Polk did not avow any plan for bringing the Mexican War to an end, because he didn't want to admit that he was waging the war to conquer more territory, specifically to conquer California. Eventually, the truth came out indirectly, as knowledge of the purposes of the Polk administration generally did. In the end, a faction of his own party, feeling misled and betrayed, rose in rebellion against his administration. And much to Polk's chagrin, the Whig candidate, Zachary Taylor, won the presidency in 1848. The contrast between President Lincoln and President Polk is highly instructive. Despite his astonishing achievements in expanding the domain of the United States, Polk has never been a hero to the American public, never been held up as a moral exemplar to schoolchildren. His material accomplishments have not been sufficient in the absence of demonstrated moral integrity to earn him the coveted designation of a great president. Where Lincoln was known as Honest Abe, James K. Polk's contemporaries nicknamed him Polk the Mendacious. Thank you all very much.